Hello, Douglas Hardy here on Monday, the 4th of May. Today, The Guardian reveals the case of a foreign doctor who killed a patient during his first shift on duty in the UK.
We've discovered that a foreign doctor accidentally killed a patient by giving him 10 times the normal recommended maximum dose of a pain-killing drug.
Airline pilots prepare to take legal action against the government's ID card scheme. And in Pakistan, refugees are fleeing the latest fighting in the northwest of the country.
Many of them complaining of being caught in the crossfire between the army and the militants.
Before all that, the latest news and a look at the papers.
There are now 900 cases of swine flu around the world, according to the World Health Organization. These are cases that have been checked for the virus in laboratories. The health minister for Mexico, where the outbreak started, says that in his country, the epidemic is in decline. But the WHO urged governments around the world not to lower their guard, as the virus has appeared in 18 countries. It's said to be widespread in the USA. The health watchdog, the Care Quality Commission, is investigating a case where a German doctor accidentally gave a patient a lethal overdose. The doctor, Daniel Ubani, flew into Britain the day before the incident in February a year ago. He wrote to the family of the victim in July apologising, saying that he'd been overtired and had been confused between pain-killing drugs. Silvio Berlusconi's wife is asking for a divorce. The Italian Prime Minister's wife, Veronica, has become exasperated with his attention to younger women, and one paper reports her as saying that she cannot stay with a man who frequents minors. Recently, she complained to reporters about his attempt to select a group of attractive young women as candidates for the European Parliament. Bob Dylan is back at the top of the British album charts, nearly 40 years after his last number one. The official charts company named his latest album, Together Through Life, as his seventh UK top album. His last was New Morning back in 1970. But it's bad news for another American icon, the newspaper The Boston Globe. The deadline the parent company, The New York Times, gave management and the unions has run out. It was calling for $20 million of cuts from the unions, but has had no response. The company has now issued a legal notice of its plan to shut the paper entirely. Not one newspaper has the same front page lead story this morning. The Guardian starts with the story of a German doctor who apologised for killing a patient. It reprints his letter in full. The Mirror features another sad story, reporting that Kate and Jerry McCann may never cease searching for their missing daughter Madeline. The headline reads, "Kate and Jerry, it's a life sentence." The Sun tells us that Princess Eugenie, the Queen's granddaughter, was mugged with her friends while on a gap year trip to Cambodia. She was rescued by two bodyguards. The Independent focuses on education and the conference vote of the head teachers' union, the NAHT. Teachers set to axe school tables, says the headline. Head's action threatens two pillars of Labour's education reform, pupil tests and league tables. The Financial Times reports that car company Fiat plans to create a European giant. After last week telling us that it was trying to create a merger with Chrysler in the United States, now the Italian company is trying to link up with Chrysler and GM's European arms. However, the paper also reports that many British jobs are at risk as the government considers whether it should pull out of the order for a new Eurofighter plane for the Air Force. And several papers keep the political pot boiling. The Guardian quotes the former Labour leader, Neil Kinnock, who says in a warning to Labour MPs, back Brown or boost BNP. The Mail talks about a sense of crisis around the PM as plotters circle wounded Brown. It claims that Health Secretary Alan Johnson has astonished colleagues by refusing to rule himself out as a replacement leader. And the story in The Telegraph quotes, Harman, I'd fight for leadership. There's more news and sport throughout the day at guardian.co.uk.
In February of last year, 70-year-old David Gray, a retired British aerospace manager from Suffolk, died after being accidentally given an overdose of painkillers. The drug was administered by a locum for an out-of-hours GP service. That doctor was Daniel Ubani, who had recently flown in from Germany to work here in the UK. James Meikle has been following this story since Mr. Gray's death.
We've discovered that a foreign doctor who was on his first UK shift doing out-of-hours cover for GPs accidentally killed a patient by giving him 10 times the normal recommended maximum dose of a pain-killing drug.
Now, this was some time ago. So how has the story unravelled since then?
Well, this was in February 2008. Obviously, the authorities at the time, as soon as they discovered the error had been made, were very keen to investigate it. But at the same time, a police investigation started into the whole incident. And eventually, over the months, they gathered enough evidence for looking at a possible manslaughter charge. And then there was a lot of to-ing and fro-ing with the German authorities, because, of course, he was a German doctor and had returned to Germany, over the subsequent legal proceedings.
And how had he come to be working in the UK?
He was a locum. He was a locum GP, and he'd actually got himself on the role of an agency. The agency supplied a company called Take Care Now, which contracts with the NHS to provide out-of-hours cover. And that company, TCN, was working with another company called Suffolk Doctors on Call, which provides the actual service. It's a very, very complicated arrangement.
So this has obviously then raised questions about how, you know, doctors from other countries are allowed to and what processes they have to go through to come and work here.
Oh, I think so. I think there'll be a big concern about this case. There's been previous worries about the registration of doctors. There's a lot of worry about fragmentation of out-of-hours services and how those are monitored.
And what have the victim's family had to say about all of this?
The victim's family, of course, are, as the story unravels, they've got more and more worried. They are taking legal action over this separately, in a civil suit. But they believe that this instance ought to worry and concern all Britons who use the health service.
Now, you mentioned that the doctor has gone back to Germany and a certain action has been taken against him there. But how does that leave then in terms of what the British authorities can do?
Yes, German authorities have told us that last month this doctor, Dr. Daniel Ubani, was actually given a 9-month suspended prison sentence and fined €5,000 for causing death by negligence. Exactly where it leaves us is still being investigated. But as far as the family are concerned, they don't believe the true story may ever emerge, at least not in a criminal case. And certainly it is true that the Department of Health in London told us on Friday night that it is disappointed that this doctor, although now convicted of an offence, has not been held to account in this country. And certainly the Cambridgeshire Police, or Cambridgeshire Constabulary, to give them their proper full title, have told us that they're disappointed that any prosecution wasn't allowed to reach its natural conclusion in this country. But of course, you have to remember that the investigation here was for manslaughter. The conviction was for causing death by negligence.
You've seen letters also written by the doctor, haven't you?
I have. It's one letter, actually, that was sent to the family, and it's dated July 2008. And in there, he asks for forgiveness, and in quite a detailed account of his movements the day before he began his shift, he said, in effect, that he had trouble navigating his way around the east of England to get to his shift, and he was also said that he was extremely tired when he was on the shift. And he also had not used the drug he administered when he administered the drug, which isn't used in such circumstances, on-call circumstances, back home in Germany.
And does the sentence that he received in Germany mean that he will not be allowed to practice again?
That is very unclear, because in Germany, the authorities have not yet officially told the German Medical Association, which regulates his behaviour in Germany. In this country, the General Medical Council has suspended him. In these cases, doctors are suspended, and his suspension has been renewed on occasion over the last 15 months.
And that was James Meikle with that story. Britain's airline pilots are to become the first group to refuse to take part in the National Identity Card Scheme when compulsory trials begin this autumn. The British Airline Pilots Association, BALPA, which represents more than 80% of commercial airline pilots, will mount a legal challenge against the Home Office. I've been speaking with our Home Affairs editor, Alan Travis.
They're being subject of £18 million project to, if I dare use the word, pilot compulsory identity cards from this autumn at Manchester Airport and London City Airport. The government, Jackie Smith, Home Secretary, has said that 20,000 airside workers at these two airports will have to have identity cards in order to be able to be employed. And the pilots who say that they are and have been in the front line of the fight against terrorism regard these identity cards as being no use in dealing with security at all or in combating terrorism, and they regard it as an imposition. They say, rightly, that the government has only got legislation to introduce a voluntary identity card scheme into this country, and has always said that if it were made compulsory, that would be a vote for another parliament after the general election. And yet they and 20,000 other airside workers at these two airports have been singled out as guinea pigs for the scheme and will face the prospect that if they don't have an identity card, they won't be allowed airside and won't be able to do their jobs.
So where are we going to see this go? How are they going to challenge it, and what's going to happen?
Well, they're meeting MPs this week at Westminster and also Home Office, again, to voice their concerns about this. And speaking to BALPA, which is the British Airline Pilots Association, which represents 80% of pilots, they tell me that their members at both airports say that if they're presented with this situation come the autumn, they will just simply hold a meeting and decide what to do then. The prospect is that they will refuse to cooperate and that flights may well be cancelled. BALPA is not an organisation to be messed with. It has to be remembered, little known fact perhaps, that Norman Tebbit started out his political career as a spokesman for BALPA, and so it has some pedigree.
So just more broadly then on ID cards, I mean, we have been hearing rumours that it might be, you know, one of the ways in which the government tries to save a bit of money.
Yes, I think the kind of mood music we've heard in the last week is actually rather misplaced. In actual fact, behind the scenes, in the last 3 weeks, we've seen two very large contracts which lay down the building blocks of the identity card scheme being signed. One, a £365 million contract to process jointly people's passport applications and their identity card applications, which is a 10-year contract which was let 3 weeks ago to an American computer company, and also the contract to set up the basic biometric database. That's the database that's going to hold all our electronic facial images and fingerprints for both passports and identity cards, was also awarded to IBM at a cost of £265 million over the next 10 years. Jackie Smith has already warned the Conservatives also that it will cost them £40 million in penalty payments if they cancel the ID card project as it currently exists. And I think that what's been going on in the last month is that the ID cards program has become deeply embedded with the issue of passports and the next generation of biometric passports in this country to such an extent that if the Conservatives decide to cancel the ID cards project, as they promised they would do after the election if they were elected, then they may find themselves in a situation whereby it'd be very difficult to also issue passports.
Alan Travis there, I'm Douglas Hardy, and this is Guardian Daily. Coming up, it seems that the wife of Italy's Prime Minister Silvio Berlusconi has had enough and wants out of their marriage.
Guardian Daily, news and reports from around the world.
First, though, to Pakistan, where a new wave of refugees is fleeing the country's latest frontline. The Pakistani army is engaged with Taliban fighters in northwest frontier province, and civilians are moving en masse down the hillsides and onto the plains, away from the bloodshed and destruction. Our correspondent Declan Walsh explains what's going on.
It's really a result of this military operation that's been taking place for the last 6 days in Bunair district, close to Swat, where the government had signed a peace deal with the Taliban. The military has sent a fairly significant force in there. There's been a lot of fighting going on mountain passes leading into Bunair, and also around the main town, which is called Dagar. So in the first few days of the operation, very few people had been able to leave because there's a 24-hour curfew imposed in most of this place. It's a rather remote mountain valley, even though it's only 60 miles from Islamabad. But over the last 4 days or so, there's been rather large numbers of people streaming out of Bunair, bringing tales of what life is like, many of them complaining of being caught in the crossfire between the army and the militants.
So what is your analysis then of what is going on in Pakistan at the moment? It seems to be building up at the moment.
Well, the country is under huge international pressure. The operation in Bunair was preceded by about a week of really quite unprecedented criticism from American officials, ranging from Hillary Clinton to the Defense Secretary and even more recently Barack Obama himself, who said that he felt that President Asif Ali Zardari's government was not delivering even the most basic services to the people of Pakistan. First among those at the moment, of course, is security in the Northwest Frontier province, where the government had signed this very controversial peace deal with the Taliban in the Swat Valley after the government kept what it said was its part of the deal and agreed to the implementation of Sharia law in Swat. The Taliban sort of pressed their advantage and started sending fighters into areas like Bunair. This was a red line for the Americans and indeed, it has to be said, for many people here in Pakistan who were very alarmed. And that's what prompted this military operation to try and push these Taliban militants out of the adjoining districts and at the very least send them back into Swat.
But from what it sounds like, there is really no prospect to the end of the fighting in Pakistan at the moment.
No, it's very hard to see where the sort of exit point for all of this is. Even with the success that the military says that it's having in Bunair, and it has managed to push the Taliban back to some degree, the country remains in a very precarious situation. The Taliban control pretty much all of the tribal areas which are along the Afghan border. And with this deployment of an extra 20,000 or so American troops in Afghanistan over the next couple of months, we're expecting to see a lot of action along that border area. That again is going to increase the pressure on the Pakistanis from the Americans. So they're hoping to at least get things under control in Swat, but there's really a long, long way to go before the country is back in a stable situation.
Declan Walsh there. Also on The Guardian's website today, keep up to date with the latest developments in Mexico and around the world at guardian.co.uk/swineflu. Madonna's latest attempts to adopt another Malawian child will be heard at the country's Supreme Court today. Latest details on that story at guardian.co.uk/world. And Mark Lawson welcomes the revival of John Mortimer's TV dramas, which daringly chronicled the changing face of Britain in the latter half of the 20th century. Go to guardian.co.uk/culture for more on that. And in the latest Media Talk USA podcast out on Tuesday, we look at whether magazines are doomed. Plus, Jeff Jarvis speaks to Craig Newmark, who's the founder of Craigslist.org, the most basic of basic-looking websites, which has 22 billion page views per month. guardian.co.uk/MediaTalkUSA is the address there. The wife of the Italian Prime Minister, Silvio Berlusconi, is to ask for a divorce. Veronica Lario is reported to have contacted a lawyer to begin proceedings after a series of public disputes with her husband, apparently over the close attention he pays to younger women. Our Rome correspondent, Tom Kington, has been following the latest controversy to surround the Italian leader.
She has told an Italian press agency that she will be looking to ask for a divorce, but it's still pretty unclear what the exact reasons are. We can speculate that this is linked to her complaint last week about her husband allegedly putting up as candidates for European elections a number of young female TV presenters, Big Brother contestants, and singers, which she described as shamelessly trashy. It could also be related to the fact that Berlusconi was reportedly spotted at the birthday party in a Naples nightclub of a blonde 18-year-old girl. And it struck Veronica Lario at the time that it was odd, given that Berlusconi had failed to turn up for the 18th birthday of his own children.
Now, will there be much surprise in Italy about these allegations?
No one is really shocked by this, particularly given that in 2007 she had already written an open letter to an Italian newspaper blasting Berlusconi for having flirted at a TV awards show with a TV showgirl and also with another person, Mara Carfagna, who he later nominated as his minister for equal opportunities.
What is Berlusconi's standing in the popularity stakes there at the moment like?
Very good. He has deftly handled the recent earthquake in Abruzzo. He's been up there a lot and has been appearing to be very much in charge of the rescue efforts and now the reconstruction efforts. He himself boasted the other day that his popularity figures were higher than Obama's. So he's really riding the crest of a wave at the moment. So that might also help him get through this.
I mean, nothing seems to really, if I mean, you mentioned Obama, he made that gaffe about mentioning the colour of Obama's skin. I mean, even things like that don't seem to affect his standing, do they?
He loves to play to the gallery. He loves to be the comedian who is very much outside mainstream politics. And that wins him a lot of points here. He directs a lot of these comments to, if you like, an imaginary bloke at the bar who would chuckle and say, good old Silvio, he's not like the rest of these drab politicians. And to a certain extent, I think that works.
Tom Kington reporting from Rome. That's all for today. I'm Douglas Hardy. The producer was Ian Chambers. Thanks for listening. Goodbye for now.